What's up, everybody? Welcome to the new Game Theory and Strategy show that we're doing here on Rotor Grinders. I'm your host, Jeff El Jefe, and I've got two guests here with me for what's going to be a fun show, I think. I've got to start off with Head Chopper, though. Head Chopper, it's my first show with you. Looking forward to talking to one of the legends. How are you doing?
I'm doing good, man. I'm just still trying to figure out how I got put on the Smart Guy show. I just play Westbrook and fade Caron Butler is what I thought I was going to be doing, but... it should be fun, man, and interesting. I always look forward to talking to other guys who are smarter than me and learning stuff from them, so this should be fun.
Oh, come on. I was told before the show that you started a new segment on Roto Grinders where you recommended Markieff to everyone. Is that right?
You know what? I recommended Markieff at like 11 in the morning, too, before the news came in. But, sometimes you get lucky like that and things break your way. And you just hope that that good karma can – offset those times when you make a bad pick and everybody jumps on you for yeah. Leading them astray.
For sure. Well, we're stoked to be doing a show with you, man. My old pal Jordan, what's up, man? How's the NBA season treating you?
It's going all right, man. It's going the learning curve is sharp, but I'm picking it up pretty quickly. So pumped to be on this show, pumped to be working with Chop. He's going contrarian with the no beard look. So I wish I'd seen it coming and I could have shaved off right before the show and I would have felt a lot better, but now I'm in the same pool with Jeff. We're heavy. Yeah,
the beard's the chalk, man. Beard's the chalk.
They are the chalk, man. I had one yesterday, and like by the morning time, I was like, this ain't working. It was itching me. So I just got rid of everything yesterday.
See, we're already talking game theory, but let's get into it. Basically, what we want to do on this show is give everyone an idea of what game theory is and how we can apply it to DFS. I think a good way to do that is with a non-DFS example, just so everyone can see like what game theory is for what it is without like the DFS biases involved. The most popular example of game theory that gets thrown around is what's called the prisoner's dilemma. So the prisoner's dilemma, where say we're all out in Manitowoc County and I arrest JM and Chop for a crime that was committed. I put them in separate rooms and tell them both the same thing. If neither of you confess to a crime or testify against each other, you're both going to jail for a year. If one of you testifies against the other, then the guy that testifies can go, and the other guy goes to jail for 3 years. If both of you rat each other out, then you go to jail for 2 years. So what this does is it creates this game of sorts where these two prisoners, without knowing what the other one is going to say, has to figure out the optimal response to this. You know, if they pretty much cooperate with each other and don't say anything, then they're only going to get a little bit of time. But if you take the chance of ratting the other guy out for the chance that you can go free, you're both going to get some extended time. And, you know, this is talked about a lot. Like, they run algorithms for this exact game. They have tournaments for this. I'll drop the link to the Wikipedia page that talks about all the math that's involved that goes into this. But I just think in general, it's a really good example, of course, of what game theory is. So Chop, let me start with you. Basic thoughts on game theory in general. I don't know if you have an example, like a real life example or anything, but what are your basic just thoughts on game theory?
I mean, game theory is as important in daily fantasy sports as trying to find the top projected players that night, because every single night, guaranteed, the majority of the nights, you're not going to be able to put together, you're not going to be able to find those guys that just guarantee you, you know, you're not going to be able to find that roster that guarantees you 310 points on fan. None of that is guaranteed, but your process of how you get there and the game selection, game theory, that's always guaranteed. If you have the right tools right there, then you're already ahead of the field. And that's one of the things that can keep you surviving is the game theory. And it's very important, man. I can't even stress. I've always stressed that those kind of decisions you make outside of actually choosing players, that's the easy stuff, man. None of that is guaranteed. And that's why it's so easy, because there is no optimal. There'll never be an algorithm that's going to pump out the optimal NBA lineup, NFL lineup, whatever, every night, no matter how, what everybody, because there's just too many variables involved. So if you're on the right track with your game theory and those types of things, you're ahead of everybody.
Yeah, and that's why ownership percentage is talked about so much, right? Because if you're using game theory, then you're understanding that there isn't going to be this optimal lineup that is for sure going to work, that there is some variance there. So that's where some opportunity arises. JM, let me get you in here. What are your basic thoughts on game theory?
Yeah, I talked about that in the, I think it was my roster construction course for Roto Academy for NFL. And I actually, that's one of my favorite courses because it really applies to every sport in a lot of areas. But one thing I talked about in the intro to that was the commercials that made it out. Like if you're smarter than the average fan, if you know the sport better than the average fan, you'll make money in DFS. And I can't tell you how many friends I've talked to who have been like, man, I know so much about the NFL. How am I not making more money? And it's because 50% of DFS is knowing the sport. And then the other 50% is knowing the game theory behind DFS. So when you're playing, you're not just playing against other people who know the sport, but you're also playing against these people who have studied the game theory of daily fantasy, which is why I think this show is cool, because it gives us kind of an hour every other week or whatever it ends up being to really dig into this side of the game, which really isn't talked about enough outside of little snippets in articles.
Yeah, no doubt. And you know, so what I wanted to do too is break this show into two big main categories. One, which we're going to call game theory, which is basically everything you do before you set your lineups. And then one, which we're going to call strategies, which is what you're doing when you're setting your lineups, you know, the strategies that you're using then based on the work you had done before. So hopefully separating that away from each other will make it a little easier to follow and understand. So game theory, again, as we're defining it in this section, is going to be everything you look at before building your lineup. So ownership percentage, game selection, scouting your opponents, figuring out if your opponent is strong or not, what your opponent likes to do. Like in a live final, there's a lot of big names. There's a lot of people with very well-known strategies. Like if you're in a live final with Beef I'm a Jeep, you know he's going to be super contrarian, and you can use that information to help develop a strategy for yourself. Site-based value is one thing that Eddie has talked about a lot, and it is very valuable as well. So if there's a value for a specific player on FanDuel where, say, Russell Westbrook is underpriced, you're probably going to want to have more exposure there than you would on DraftKings, where he's a little more overpriced. And then, you know, a whole nother game theory around that can be, well, that's going to affect ownership percentages. And, you know, so how am I going to adjust there? And then there's correlation plays, which we talk about a lot in football, of course, with stacking in baseball, but it's not talked about a ton in basketball. And there are definitely ways that you can find correlation plays in basketball. So Chop, let me get back to you again. Which out of these things that I've been talking about in regards to game theory or something I haven't talked about is something that's one of your favorite to utilize?
For me, I think it's easily game selection. By that, I mean, like, all right, so if I ask you, like, what do you draft cheat? What kind of player is he? He's a GPP guy, right? He's large field. Like, that's what he's known for. That's what he does. That's his thing. And if I go the other way and I say big time cash player, like you think of somebody like CSU Ram, like just grinds out cash games, like thousands and thousands of a night. So like those guys have their predetermined thing, and that's fine. But if somebody were to ask me what I am, like, I couldn't even answer that. I'm all over the place. And it all depends on the slate. Is like, I don't like to just register for games and just have a set, you know, I'm going to do this ABC. I let the slate dictate what kind of player I'm going to be that night. If it's a small slate or a large slate, if there's a lot of values opened up early in the morning, or if I see stuff opening up later at night, if there's a hardcore set of studs I want to take, you know, that all can dictate. Like last night, you have a guy like Markieff Morris broke, you know, and I see a guy like that in Josh Smith, and I say, this is a great game. This is a great night to get in cash games, because I'm hoping the other guys, that one other guy that I'm playing, is going to make the mistake of not rostering those guys when they should be. And if you're in a tournament and you know Smith and you know Morris and these guys are going to be heavily owned, so you're not gaining a ton of advantage there, but you can gain a big advantage in your cash games. But on the other hand, If you go back to like last week when Oklahoma City and Houston squared off and you had Westbrook, Durant, and Harden were just clear plays, man. They were so good. That's a great night to multi-enter tournaments because instead of trying to strike a nine-man combination, you've got three spots reserved already, and now you're down to six guys. You just need to rotate around them and just find that good combination, that level lottery pick. So I let the slate determine what kind of player I'm going to be that night. And I don't think a lot of people – give enough thought into that going in every night.
I think that's really awesome. I've talked about that a bit recently in baseball, which most viewers and you guys know that I'm still learning NBA. I've been profitable this year, but I'm basically playing at small stakes and just getting to a point where I know it as well as I know other sports. But with MLB, I think that's a great sport for picking and choosing slates based on how things shape up. And I kind of have a budget for what I want to play nightly, and then I'll determine where I want to put that money based on the type of slate. And a lot of that, I don't know, Jeff, you want me to jump into the part I wanted to talk about?
Yeah, go for it, man.
Because I want to talk about studying ownership percentage, which is something I talked about in my Friday article a couple weeks ago, is something you should really do every single night, is just study ownership percentage and not necessarily saying I'm studying to see how highly owned this guy is or this guy, but more just look at everything and you start picking up things. So certain players that go regularly go under owned for whatever reason, or in baseball, there are certain pitchers people don't like to roster. Whereas if you understand the numbers and you can spot, okay, this guy is in a great spot tonight and he's going to go low owned, and this pitcher is going to go highly owned and I really don't like him that much, then that's a great night to go GPP because you can zero in on this pitcher who's the best pitcher by the numbers, but is going to be lower owned. So I think that's really important. And that's something, I mean, I think Chop, you're the first person I've really heard talk about that on a show because that's not really something people think about. And I think that's a big thing for success. But yeah, so tying into studying ownership percentages, there's three things that I've kind of highlighted lately that I've noticed, and I want to get your guys' thoughts on them. So one is I've noticed that on DraftKings, price is influenced by ownership. Adam talked about that on our Friday night show during football, but there are certain guys like Chris Middleton, Greg Monroe, Jimmy Butler earlier in the year who are going overvalue every night. I mean, Middleton, Monroe at right about 7K are scoring 35 to 40 every night, and yet they're always 10% owned in cash games. I think when you notice guys like that, or Jimmy Butler earlier in the year when he was 7,800 and people didn't want to pay that much for him, even 7,500, people weren't paying that much for him. He was 7,500 and, 10 to 15% owned. So I think spotting the guys who are regularly going lower owned and hitting value is a great way to recognize that the pricing algorithm considers ownership percentage. So instead of saying, why is this guy always so low owned? Say the fact that this guy's so low owned makes him a great play.
Exactly. Yeah. I think that's good. Chop, any thoughts on that overall?
Yeah, just, I agree with what he's saying. You know, you look for those things and you got to take advantage of them. Like, people are real hesitant, like he was saying, the exact prices. Like when a guy comes out and he's a good value one night and then the price jumps on him because of a performance, people will hesitate to get back on that train because they don't want to pay the extra money. But in actuality, you got to be able to see through that and go, he's still not priced accordingly. He's still too low. So I'm going to get back on him and all these other people are not. Because they think, you know, they don't want to pay the extra money, but he's still going to outperform that salary. You take advantage of those things right there.
Yeah, I think so. One of the big things is when you're starting your research for an NBA slate, or this is the way I do it anyway. I'm not looking at prices or anything. I'm just looking at, okay, where are the best matchups going to be? And what are the players that I'm probably going to want to target? That's a great way to start your NBA day, except for the fact that everyone does the same things. And when you're factoring ownership percentage into a pricing algorithm, that makes these teams that typically aren't good to target, like no one wants to roster the Bucks. So it makes sense that guys like Chris Middleton are going to be low owned, you know? So when you're factoring in the salary algorithm like that, it just changes everything. Like your research wanting to attack these players, well, those guys have been really popular. Like they're playing at a fast pace. They've been outperforming value, but also everyone's rostering them on DraftKings. So their price is rising. So they're not as good of a target as they might appear. But
there's also certain price ranges, like a 5K point guard on DraftKings. People tend to always skip over the guy who's 5,500, 5,700 on DraftKings. They're either going for the really cheap fill-in point guard or the really expensive guy. And so I think recognizing certain price ranges at certain positions that people skip over is big for gaining an edge in tournaments, because if you can find like Jeff Teague the other night, he'd been playing well lately. He'd been getting more minutes. He was in a good matchup. What did he put up, like 49 points or 47 points? Like, I didn't see that coming, but I liked him a lot that night. And he was still, and this is off of, you know, 5 or 6 games in a row with him surpassing value, and he was still 7% owned, I think, something like that. Mm-hmm. So when you start to recognize situations that cause people to overlook players or prices that cause people to overlook players, that's a great edge that you can gain in tournaments, which is why I think just studying ownership percentage every night is such a big thing, because you just pick up little things here and there like that.
So you said you had 3 aspects of ownership percentage.
Another one is two weeks ago on the show, it was kind of funny because I talked about how late breaking news spikes ownership percentage. And then Brett came behind me and talked about how he likes finding the late breaking news so we can get lower ownership percentage. So we kind of contradicted each other there. But what I really have found is late breaking news. Well, basically, and I was in Nashville with the Roto Grinders guys this weekend, and we talked about this a little bit, was how heavy of an influence Roto World has on ownership percentage. So like last night, I don't know, like Chop, you brought up Markeith early in the day. If Roto World had never said anything about Markeith, how high do you think his ownership would have been?
That's a good question, because that's a situation where you're on somebody and they break the news and you go, damn. They wouldn't have done that till after lock, because now he's going to be driven up when I was already on him. So it's no benefit to me. It's actually bad for me. But yeah, you're right. You know, those major news outlets like that, if you're in tune with those, then you can kind of, that gives you a good idea of the percentage of, you know.
Well, probably would have been more in line with FanDuel, right? Because on FanDuel, he was 15.6% owned, right?
I mean, yeah. And on FanDuel, there was there was speculation. Jeff and I were talking before the show. There was speculation that Markeith would be starting and that the offense would be running through more, and he was 15-16% owned. And then on DraftKings with late swap, you know, 25 minutes after the first game started, it was announced he was starting and he was over 30% owned. And then you notice things like Tyson Chandler a couple of weeks ago, when the Suns had no healthy bigs and he'd already played 36 minutes against the Spurs, and he was playing the Hawks, who have the worst rebounding differential in the NBA. And I used Tyson Chandler that night in cash at whatever he was, 4K, thinking that he was going to be 50% owned, because it just made sense. He's going to get 40 plus minutes against the worst rebounding team. And he's put up 60 points, but he was also 4% owned. And one thing I realized was no major news outlets ever said anything about, take a look at Tyson Chandler tonight. I think if they had, he would have been more like 25%, 30% owned, because there wasn't a ton of value on that slate. So people were scraping around for value, and that was a great place to look. So that's another thing, is paying attention to, I think it was Cam at Roto World Roto Grinders was saying to me that Roto World's been doing, you know, had a kind of a stranglehold on fantasy NBA news for 10 years. So that's the main place everyone looks. And even though it's season long based, as far as what they're focusing on, it really swings DFS ownership a ton. And so I think recognizing the guys that line up is a good play in your mind, and then that aren't mentioned by Roto World is a good way to find a contrarian player.
I think that all makes sense. You've got one more area you want to talk about in regards to ownership?
Yeah, so one more, and I'll touch on this quickly and see what you guys think, is sure. That everyone seems to think alike. So certain games, people are drawn toward. And there might be a game with an over-under of 213 and another one with 209. And ownership in that 213 game is massive, and ownership in the 209 game is minuscule. So I think recognizing the places like that, which again, studying ownership percentage each night, you start to get a feel for it. But the places that people are ignoring in favor of something else. So you can typically get the same production from a 209 over under as a 213. And so if you recognize that everyone's going toward this one game, that gives you an opportunity to swing toward the other in tournaments. Do you guys ever look at over unders? And as, I mean, I guess that comes into differentiation a little more than contrarian, wouldn't you say, Jeff?
Yeah, I think that I definitely look at that type of stuff. And the thing that I find a lot of value in too is the spreads. Like, I'm not as scared away from the big spreads, especially being mainly a tournament player, that most people are. So I think that in the games, you see it with the Warriors a lot, right? They're in these games where they're favored by 15, 18 points. And so no one wants to roster players from that game, right? Or their ownership is just too low. You know, they're at 15% when they should be at 30% or whatever. So I think there's a lot of value in that too, because especially with blowouts, like, even if Vegas is projecting the Warriors to win by 15, or I think it's 11 tonight, right, against the Wizards on the road, like, the Warriors are an extreme case to where they have been blowing a lot of teams out. So maybe they're not the best example, but a lot of times when a team is favored by 11 on the road, they're not going to blow out the home team. So I think there's a lot of value in getting low ownership percentage there. Chopper, your thoughts?
Yeah, I definitely factor in, you know, the Vegas spreads, and I probably use them a lot less. I definitely less in basketball than I do in, let's say, baseball and even football. And because to me, they're just not they're not as the quality of the player stands out a lot more in basketball than what Vegas says. But going to what JM said, like, it's a good way to find those guys that people are going to overlook, because in football, you get a team and they have a team total of 17. What are you going to do? People automatically, they skip over it. And I'll skip over it too in football. That's not, you know, or in baseball, somebody's got a 3.5 team total. They're facing Kershaw. You're going to glaze right over those guys. But in basketball, they do the same thing when they shouldn't on the lower totals like that. Because if you've got a stud, you've got a stud, right? So let's take a good example, I think, is Brook Lopez, constantly playing him this year and constantly looking at his ownership in tournaments, less than 10%. He's probably a top five center, but they always glaze over him because Brooklyn's constantly not given much credit for any offense, a bad team. So you find these good players like that at low ownership who can constantly deliver. I think it's a good way to go about setting a GPP roster and finding some contrarian plays who want to be contrarian, but you want to be smart. You still want to have the upside, you know, so you need those good players. How can you find them without the high ownership? You do it like that.
Yeah, and I think that the Brook Lopez example goes back to what JM was originally talking about with DraftKings, right? So there's these certain teams that everyone avoids because one of the big things everyone talks about right now in NBA is pace, right? And like, Brooklyn's not going to be a team you want to attack if you're looking for games with a high pace. So a lot of times there are teams and players like that that just get overlooked. And for sites like DraftKings that factor their pricing on ownership percentage, there's a lot of value there. One more thing before we move on from this section, talk more about specific strategies. Well, I guess this kind of is in line with the strategy is correlation. So I talked about how the other sports have obvious, you know, quarterback to wide receiver correlations. Okay, yeah. Stacking the 1-4 hitters in baseball. Yeah, obviously, those are correlated, right? In basketball, I've talked to three, four people at these live finals in football that didn't play basketball and asked them why. They're big tournament players. They said because the correlations just aren't there. And I was like floored. I was like, of course there are correlations in basketball. There's a lot of really, you know, good ways to build tournament lineups. And one way you can do that, speaking of blowouts, is say with the Warriors. Warriors are favored by 15, 17 points, something like that. Everyone's scared of the blowout. All those guys are going to reach value, or guys like Steph and Draymond are probably going to reach value if that game stays close. So roster both of them, right? Like, that's positively correlated. If they're going to play four quarters, Steph and Draymond are probably both going to pay off. And if they're going to pay off, someone from the other team's probably going to pay off too, you know, a John Wall or something like that. So that's the ways you can kind of look to build correlation plays in your NBA lineups. JM, you're a little bit new to NBA, so I don't know how much you played around with that, but Chop, do you have any, do you ever do that for NBA? Do you worry about correlations at all, or is it more just about getting the players that you want?
Oh, in tournaments, it's definitely something you have to look at. And when you're doing multiple lineups, and yeah, you definitely look at specific games and figure out how can I attack them. And you try to maybe do it, not even in the obvious way, but when I went back and, you know, for years, I always go back and kind of look at some data and see if I can find anything. And for a long time, it was like, yeah, it doesn't seem optimal to roster more than one guy from an NBA team. This was back in the prehistoric days, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, you know, but the more I looked at it, the more you see, yeah, you know, a good NBA fantasy team can support two or even three guys every night doing well. And so it only stands to reason that if you can get a couple of guys from this team and a couple of guys from the other team in the same game, you know, it all makes sense and it makes for a perfect tournament strategy. So, yeah, I'm definitely on board with that kind of thing.
Yeah, and Jordan, going to you now, one thing I may have even mentioned to you, I've been talking to a few people about NBA strategy this year, is you can look to pick and roll combos, right? Like a point guard and a big that are going to come out, set a screen, and a lot of times that point guard will dump to the post player for a dunk. And yeah, that's positively correlated. We think of that a lot with Chris Paul and DeAndre Jordan. Like, that's a really positively correlated play. Have you experimented much at all with these correlations?
Yeah, one thing that I've been doing a lot lately, well, not a lot, but any opportunity I have, is really loading up on a high usage player being out. I think if you, like a good example was Houston last night, or New Orleans, whenever that was last week when Anthony Davis was out. But you can roster five guys, like you could roster five guys from Houston last night, and they would all be highly owned. So you could, most people are only rostering three or four, right? And in cash games is what I'm talking about here. But in cash games, if you're siding with the high ownership across the board, you're usually going to finish in the money. And so if you end up with four guys, like I used four guys from Houston last night, even in a tough matchup against Miami, because Dwight Howard was out and the guys I'm using are so inexpensive that it's easy for them to hit value. Or last week when it was New Orleans against Sacramento and Anthony Davis was out, most people are using two or three guys. They're saying, who are the two best guys here with Anthony Davis out? And I just used four guys because you're saying, hey, this usage is being spread around. And so I think people get scared off of using too many guys from one team. But when a high usage player is out and these fill-in guys you can use are all cheaper, I think that's a great way to play that, even in cash games.
Yeah, it's interesting. One of the first lineups that I studied when I was starting, and I know plenty of other people studied his lineups as well in NBA, was Condia. And Condia, what he used to do in cash games was essentially stack a game a lot. Like, he would take three players from one team and two players from the other, figuring that he's, you know, someone out of this group of guys are going to get the points and it's going to create a really high floor. I don't know if he still uses that strategy. I don't even know if that's a great strategy anymore. But it was one that he used and it worked. So as we're moving on to the strategy section here, your strategy in terms of game theory and DFS is like, this is your move. Game theory, you'll hear moves talked about a lot, but it's basically the approach you're taking when you're building your lineup. Being contrarian is the most popular one, which is ironic, but there are a lot of other strategies. Game stacking is one. Differentiation, two, purposely fading a guy in order to get a different roster construction, which we've talked about a lot in NFL, Jordan. There's multi-entry and like how to approach multi-entry, like core building, or just how much exposure you want to different players. There's trains that you can use in tournaments. There's fading players, you know, there's a lot of different strategies. Chop, let me start with you. Like, is there one specific strategy that you find yourself gravitating towards in tournaments, or is it a mix of a bunch of different things?
Yeah, well, I would say that if you're playing, you know, multiple entry in tournaments, which a lot of people do now, if you are using anything, a lineup builder, whatever you're using, or doing it by hand, if you're out there plugging away and just trying to cover the bases with a lot of guys, you know, almost whatever, all the guys on your radar, you're probably going to end up losing the majority of your money that night. And over the course of time, you're going to have to keep reloading because you're not going to be that successful. In tournaments, the best way to multi-enter is to find a core. Like you said, the core strategy is the one that I've used forever now. Like, you find a core group of players, right? And you build around them. And if your core goes off, good things are going to happen kind of regardless of what you do with those other guys. You'll find some kind of success with those other guys. But, you know, you want that core. Like, you don't have to use the same core in every – if you got 100 lineups that night, you don't have to use it 100 times. You can have a core group in 25 lineups and another core in another – and a lot of times that core, if you really want upside, you take it from the same game, like the Harden, Westbrook, Durant thing I mentioned. Like, you know, I like the – that's the way I approach GPPs is when I multi-enter – is to build a core, find that core group I want and build around them.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. Certainly a very popular strategy last year. I see it used a ton this year. People do it in baseball by stacking, you know, a certain four hitters on FanDuel, say, and then mixing a bunch of lineups around those four hitters and a pitcher combination or whatever. And that works well. In basketball, I know guys that qualified for a lot of tournaments by building around a core, you know, a core of five guys, and then just kind of mixing in guys around that. There's a lot of value in that. Jordan, your thoughts on cores?
Man, you guys wait till we get to doing this show during MLB, because you know what's contrarian is not stacking at all, which is what I do a lot of times in MLB, and especially in smaller field tournaments. I can create a big edge, but that'll be fun once we get to baseball. Also, we got to do more shows with Chop, because Chop says a lot of good stuff, but Chop, you're also easy to listen to. So bring you on board all the time. We recruit you to our shows. I had a theory I wanted to present to you guys and see what you guys thought about this. So in my mind, from what I'm seeing, Chop said this earlier, and I talk about this a lot, is when you're being contrarian, you want to make smart plays. So you're finding the plays that'll be underowned, but are still smart plays. So I found in NBA, because I haven't followed the NBA closely as a fan throughout my lifetime, so I don't have all these preconceived notions and biases. And so I've been building a lot of teams that are just smart teams by research and to end up being contrarian. And so I feel like in NFL, if you trust the research, it's going to lead you to the highest owned guys, because and there's situations like Allen Robinson early in the year when Jeff and I seemed to be the only people in the country who liked him, and he was always low owned. Situations like that, for the most part, people have a week to prepare. So everybody's talking about the right research and getting to the high owned guys. And in MLB, you know, you take risks because anybody can go 0-for-4 or anybody can have two hits on a night. But it seems like in NBA, a lot of times people have these preconceived biases that pull them off certain players. And I'm rambling now, but I'm going to get to my, my point. And since I'm probably losing half of the viewers here, but my point was, if you trust your research by the numbers, a lot of times you can build really contrarian lineups without necessarily going out of your way to do that. And as long as you're trusting your research, then you end up with, so a few examples I had was Devin Booker last night seemed to be a really good play on paper, but he was still whatever 5% owned. I don't even know what his final score was, but I know he had close to 30 points and probably 6 or 7 three pointers.
Yeah,
ahead.
Yeah.
Jeremy Grant, when he was filling in at power forward, so you could roster a power forward in your small forward slot. I forget who he was playing, but he had a 40 plus point game at 4K, where he was just in a great matchup for a power forward, and so you can use a power forward in your small forward slot, and he was super low owned. Aaron Gordon playing power forward against Boston. JJ Barea last week, Cal Spears was building some qualifier lineups, and he asked me how highly owned Aaron Gordon and Barea would be, and we hypothesized they'd both be 40 to 50% owned. and they were like 14% and 10% owned. So a lot of times just smart plays end up being lower owned because people have these preconceived biases. And if you just trust the research by the numbers and the matchup, you actually end up with some contrarian plays just naturally.
Well, I think that's a great point, especially for someone like you who's just getting into NBA. And maybe, you know, you were probably the best guy at projecting NFL ownerships. Like between you, me, and Adam, like it seemed like you always nailed ownership percentages. And, you know, maybe you're not quite there in NBA, whereas someone who's been around a little bit longer has a better idea of how to project those ownership percentages, where the popular guys are going to be. So I think that that would be a great approach for you. Just like, don't even worry about ownership percentages. For someone that is able to project those ownership with a little more confidence, I think that the best advice for them is to look, start with your research for the day. You have your list of players, whether it be on a piece of paper, in your spreadsheet, on your computer, whatever. Have your guys that you're confident in. And then as you know, the way you figure out ownership percentages, okay, how much are these guys being talked about on Twitter, on RotoGrinders, the consensus rankings? Like, that's how you can start to gauge how popular these players are going to be. And then go back and look at your list and say, well, no one's talking about this guy and I like this guy. You know, it's not about just finding a guy no one's talking about. It's about finding a guy that you like that no one is talking about. So that would be the approach that I'd encourage people to do. Chop, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, you're right on that. That plus the recency bias that people tend to have. You know, you can almost go out there and predict ownership percentages based on those things. Like, you sit down, and especially on FanDuel, it's really easy whenever you consider that you've got such a finite amount of rosters. You can only have one center every night, you know? And so in a 1,000-person tournament, you're going to have 1,000 center spots available. So, you know, we could chalk up 350 of them to DeMarcus Cousins because we know he's going to be. So where is that going to leave the other 650, you know? And then you start going down the line and saying, well, this is going to be the next guy, and that's going to eat up this many spots. Oh, well, look here, I'm left with Andre Drummond at about 10%, something like that, a super high upside guy and along those lines. So it's not hard, and it's a little bit extra time, but it's definitely worth it in tournaments to figure that kind of stuff out.
Yeah, no doubt. JM, any more thoughts?
No, I mean, just, yeah, like you said, I mean, predicting ownership, I guess the deeper into a sport you are, the more capable you are of doing that. And there's been a few spots, like I think with Jeremy Grant, I knew he'd be low owned, but just the research told, you know, showed me that it was a good play and that I knew he could hit 22 points and that he had upside for more. But that really, I mean, it comes back around to trusting your research, and you kind of end up with some contrarian plays just out of the fact that people have these biases, or especially on FanDuel, like Chop was saying, where people are forced to roster two small forwards and people can only use one center. That really limits the options, and you can get a better feel for what's this really strong play that nobody's going to be on.
Yeah, no doubt. One more strategy that I kind of wanted to talk about is game stacking, because I think that that's one that a lot of people either experiment with when they're first starting, or just you hear a lot of talk about it. My thoughts, and I've shared this before on previous shows, so I apologize to people who have heard it and I'm being a little bit redundant, but it's a good example of why you need to constantly analyze things. Because last year, game stacking, and what I mean by that is taking four players from one team on FanDuel, four players from the team that they're playing on FanDuel, and plugging in that random other position for whoever. That's why I consider a full game stack. That used to work last year sometimes because no one else was really doing it. There's a 5% chance a game's going to go into overtime when that happens. And these games that are going to be high paced and the guys are probably going to pay off their value anyway, get that extra 5 minutes or sometimes double overtime or whatever, you're probably going to win a GPP. Problem is, people started noticing these teams every once in a while at the top of the slams and go, oh, that's how you win the slam, is you just stack this game, right? So more people started doing it. So now that 5% chance of this game going to overtime isn't as profitable because there are more people doing it and you have to beat more teams. So that's what game theory is, in a sense, is like looking at the math of it all. If there's this probability that I need to have a really good chance of winning, then this is a decision that I should do or shouldn't do. Chop, do you have any thoughts on game stacking? Is that something you ever do?
Oh, yeah, sure, man. Listen, the whole DFS, it evolves every single season. Every single sports season is different than the last. Like, I remember the first time I saw game stacking in baseball was several years ago. I faced a guy in a high-dollar head-to-head, and I looked at his lineup, and he had all the Yankees. And I was like, what is this garbage, you know? We go into the seventh inning, and I'm beating him, and I look, and I notice the Yankees put up about four or five runs. I go and check the scoreboard, and he beat me. I was like, whoa. I was like, that works, you know? And then the next thing you know, I remember there was like a nine-way tie for one of those qualifier seats, because this was in the early days, because everybody stacked the Padres with the same pitcher because there was no rules back then. And that's when everybody said, well, this is how you win in baseball, large field tournaments. And so now, like JM said earlier, now he finds success in not stacking because it's evolving, you know, constantly like that. And it's not just one theory that wins every night. And that's what makes DFS great. But yeah, in the right scenario, I love stacking, even in the NBA, even though I think it's less prevalent than the other sports. But you get a Phoenix Suns, they're a terrible team in general and not a whole lot there to root for or whatever. But you get them when they're decimated by injuries and you can start four of those guys at a cheap salary. You know, it's money when they all get the high usage and you're in a game and then you get a couple guys off the other game. It works in the right scenario. You just got to pick and choose your battles because people are going to stack just about every game every night. So you got to be, you know, you got to pick the right ones to go after. And that's like that old 6 o'clock thing where you look at the scoreboard at about an hour after tip off and you notice all these teams with massive numbers at the top of the leaderboard because they stacked that first game, but then they slowly fade away. So, you know, if you're picking the right game under the right circumstances, definitely profitable.
Yeah, man. Dexter likes to stack on FanDuel. That's for sure. So JM, why don't you talk about the process of how you got to the point of realizing that, say, not stacking in baseball was probably a good way to go? Because there's obviously a point where you're analyzing all this stuff and you just come to this realization. Like, can you provide any insight to that process?
That was some telepathy working right there, because I was actually going to talk about, so the place where I really like not stacking is in the 1K tournament, because it's a smaller field. It's usually about 100 entries. And so what I wanted to talk about was, I study all the other guys who play in that tournament frequently. And I know which nights, I can look at a slate and know which nights play better to certain DFS players and which nights play better to me. And so I'll try to target that tournament on nights where my style of play fits better to me, is an advantage to me and a disadvantage to these other guys in that tournament. And so, you know, there's like NFL, I don't do that. I just play the same tournaments every weekend because that's where Jeff's got this smirk on his face. I don't know what people are saying.
I'm just watching chat. That's all. No, that's fine.
Yeah. I'm needing to look at chat to see what people are saying, So football, I just play the same tournaments because you have a limited number of slates. You know, you have 17 weekends, but baseball or basketball, where you have pretty much every day, you can start to pick and choose your spots. So not everybody who's watching this plays in the 1K tournament, but one place where you can start using that strategy is in single entry tournaments. So for instance, I think the $27 single entry on DraftKings maxes out at 400 something entries, which means since it's less than 500, you can see every team in there. And usually it's going to be the same people playing in there every night. So you can start applying that strategy by looking to see what strategies different people use. And you could do it in baseball or in basketball. And then over time, you start saying, okay, these are these same things these players do all the time, and they're playing the tournament every day, and here's something I can do to differentiate. So when you see a slate that works better to a different style and might work worse for them, that gives you an opportunity to jump in that tournament. So I think that's a cool way to practice and start building up buy-in levels, is to do that at lower buy-in levels and then start recognizing just places where you can gain an edge.
Well, I think I'm glad you brought up that point too, because in NBA specifically, so game stacking, if, like I said, you're relying on a 5% occurrence, why would you use that strategy in a small field tournament, right? Like, are you going to use that in a $500 30-man queue? No, you shouldn't, because like it doesn't make sense that it's going to pay off enough for you to do that. But yeah, in baseball, it's totally different. So yeah, let's move on to the lineup review. So Max Dollery, Sahil Sood, won the Slam last night.
Yeah, has he changed his name everywhere now? Is this...
Yeah, you didn't catch that? Yeah.
Something new. I saw it last night. I'll have to get used to something new now.
He must have got a letter from the real Max Dollery being like, WTF, man. Like, what's going on? But yeah, so he had a solid night last night. And I thought I was the only one who faded James Harden. And apparently I wasn't, because he did too. James Harden had a really good night. But I thought there was a lot of value at the shooting guard position. And that it made sense to fade him. So I'm pulling up his lineup right now. Hopefully everyone can see it too. We've got a screenshot of it. Basically what he did is he went Kyle Lowry, Damian Lillard, spent up at point guard, paired Damian Lillard with CJ McCollum at shooting guard, went Andrew Wiggins against the Lakers, which, Chop, I'll get your comments on that because I saw you post on Twitter last night about it. Carmelo Anthony, Evan Turner at small forward. Carmelo was really chalky. He was 60% owned. Evan Turner was 10% owned, but again, a really sharp play, I think. Josh Smith and Markieff were his power forward, so nothing crazy there. Markieff was only 15% owned because it was FanDuel, and you had to speculate a little bit whether he was actually going to be in the starting lineup or not, but I think that was a great assumption, one that I used myself as well. And then he went Gorgui Jang at center. So yeah, like I said, the most interesting thing about this lineup to me is that he faded Harden. And if you go to the single entry tournaments too, Max faded Harden. It's not like, oh, well, he just had a bunch of lineups, so that's why he faded Harden in one of them. No, in the single entries, he also didn't use Harden. So Chop, what are the merits to fading a guy like Harden last night with guys like Andrew Wiggins, who I know you liked, and CJ McCollum?
Well, I tell you, I was. You guys aren't the only ones that faded Harden. I was on the fade Harden train also. Nice. On FanDuel. Because basically when you get a guy like that and you know he's going to be high ownership, it's a lot – the higher priced salary that he has, the easier it is to fade him. Because the more difficult it is for him to put together a game that you just can't overcome if he's not on your roster. You know, if like Miles Turner gets down there and they – tonight he's 5,500, I think, or – back when he was 4,800 or whatever, he puts together a game. He could put together a game that you're not going to get over if you fade him. So it's a lot harder to fade a guy down there. But when you're up in that 10-2, 10-5 range or more, I like to fade those guys like that because, like you said, I can always extract value down there and try to overcome that regardless of what happens with Harden in some other positions. Like he went with McCollum, which was – that's the obvious, like, elephant on this team right here, 4.9%, and a guy who went for 48 points. And there's nothing about him going into that matchup that you would say, oh, he's a terrible player, and he can't play him, or what a donkey play. He had all the peripheral things in his favor and a good player, and you got him at 5%, and you saved about $3,000, which he parlayed into a guy like Carmelo and Lillard and Lowry, which put him over the top.
And last night it was is Devin Booker or Booker and Archie Goodwin shooting guards on FanDuel?
Goodwin, I think, is at point guard.
Okay.
Booker.
And so you had Wade as well against Houston in a pace-up game with Whiteside out. So you have these other shooting guards that people want to use. So like Chop said, it's not like McCollum was a donkey play, but just there's all these other shooting guards that stand out more. Langston Galloway, I'm assuming he's listed at shooting guard on FanDuel. So all these shooting guards people want to use, which then leaves him overlooking a guy like McCollum who was in a good spot.
Yeah, the only thing that's interesting, and I see this comment in chat, someone saying CJ McCollum was an awful play. I don't know that CJ McCollum was an awful play, but it was interesting to me they used Lillard and McCollum together, because to me they're not positively correlated. And if I were going to use both of them, I would probably pair one or two bucks with them in the hope that it just becomes a shootout. And, you know, because in the instance that Lillard and McCollum are both going to pay off, it has to be a really high scoring game. And that means you want some bucks in there, too. So I agree in that sense, like that this isn't a perfect lineup or anything. I will say at shooting guard, the one thing that led me to want to fade Harden was Chris Middleton. I knew that after the game he had the night before, and even the one before that, like, people were done with Chris Middleton. And to me, like, he's still getting the shots up. And he had an awful shooting night. He missed his first 9 shots, ended up with 38.1 FanDuel points at 5% owned. Like, that's why I went away from Harden. Didn't work out for me as well as it did for Max, but I had a solid night. But yeah, Markieff Morris is the key here. Of course, at 15% owned, pretty much anyone who rostered Markieff with a decent lineup cashed. Evan Turner is one guy I want to talk about because I think it applies again today. And if you guys watched the lineup building show before ours this morning, they talked about Evan Turner. So Evan Turner gets a matchup here against a team that with a really weak defensive bench. And Evan Turner's been getting a lot of minutes. And Siege pointed out that Marcus Smart's shots aren't dropping. So that could lead to more usage for Turner. And I think that makes a lot of sense. Turner's a guy I'm pretty high on again today, and he's probably not going to be super highly owned because he's a bench player, right? Before we move on, Chop, any thoughts? I wouldn't mind getting to some questions in the chat. If you guys have any, fire them up, but make it less player versus player and more strategy-based questions. Go ahead, Chop, anything to say?
On this particular lineup, like, he used some really good game theory with the Evan Turner pick because he looked at the Carmelo. He saw Carmelo was like the one legitimate small forward. And then after that, you had the leeway to do a lot of different things and it wouldn't hurt you because there was no Durant. There's no LeBron. There's no, you know, there was nobody out there that was going to kill you. So I can take a chance here and still finish in the top 10 or top 10% at least in a tournament. And he took a chance with Turner and it paid off into a win actually.
Yeah, and again, look at this lineup. Like, it doesn't have to be completely contrarian to win a huge tournament. We're talking about over 11,000 people in this tournament. Like, it's not a bunch of 1%ers, right? There's one guy under 5%. That was McCollum. There's two guys under 10%. You throw Evan Turner in there. Markieff's at 15%, who I think is the key. But other than that, like, it's a lot of chalk. It's Gorgui Dieng, 41%. Josh Smith, 37%. Carmelo 60%, Lillard 32%. Like, that's a lot of chalk. So you don't have to go complete chalk in your lineups. Question in the chat was, so that means we should fade Turner today since the first two shows have talked about him. That's game theory in a sense because you're projecting higher ownership percentage than you would have had otherwise. But I think that Roto Grinders
gotta pay small attention to what swings ownership percentage.
I think the Roto Grinders two morning shows are a really small sample of what's going to happen in the slam today, but that's just me. Maybe I don't know our own pool. Chop, I saw a question there asking how your approach differs in a single entry tournament versus multi-entry.
You know, the obvious thing for me is that I want to make the single entry a lot more closer to a cash game roster. I want a little bit more because you don't have to take some huge risks. Like, you just don't have to. And so I like to take but it needs to be a good combination because it's still a tournament and you still got to siphon through a bunch of different opponents. So, but I want to make it, I can lean a little bit more cash game friendly in a single entry tournament as opposed to just going overboard with a game stack that you would play in the slam when you're facing 11,000 other people. But so I tend to make those a little bit safer and take a little bit extra time on those.
Yeah, so Jordan, I don't know how much you've looked at the NBA slate tonight, but someone's asking if Jordan Hill and Miles Turner are positively correlated or not. Could you use them in the same lineup together? If you don't have an opinion, I can answer.
Yeah, no, don't ask me. Let's hear what you say.
Yeah, so my thoughts on situations like that is when guys are so cheap and there's so much added value presented due to an injury or something, like Jan Mahinmi is out tonight. You don't necessarily even have to worry about correlations. They're still good plays together because you're projecting for, say, Jordan Hill 6-7x tonight probably, and Miles Turner 5-6x. So like, if they're not really going to be dependent, they're not capping each other at all because they're so cheap. That would be my response to that. So I'm glad we got to answer a couple questions, but that's pretty much it for the show. Looks like we ran out of time. A couple of really good shows coming up, so make sure you stay tuned to those. Jordan, final thoughts on everything.
Yeah, we're done at 25 after.
Yep.
Shows how much.
Oh, yeah. No, No, that's you're used to the night shows. So the night shows, we don't have anyone after us. But now that there's two shows after us, they need like a little gap in between to prep for everything. So
oh, there you go. Yeah, no, no final thoughts from me. See you guys in a couple weeks.
Chop, final thoughts, man?
Yeah, like I said, I'll bring it back full circle. Like I said at the beginning, be self-aware. You know, take time to study yourself at the end of the night and know what you do good, know what you do bad. Try to play to your own strengths, man. And game theory is as important as anything else in fantasy. I guarantee it.
Absolutely. Yeah. Me being a tournament player, qualifier player, I can't tell you how much I think about and probably overthink about all the factors involved when it comes to, especially like thinking about what my opponent's going to do in a live final. Like that's probably overthinking it, but I still do it. Like I want to always have as much information as possible and think about as much as I can and then make the decisions. But we appreciate everyone tuning in. Thank you to everyone in chat for participating. Glad I finally got to answer some questions on a show. I usually run over time. I usually just say screw the questions, we're not doing those, but I answered two, so that's a big step. Yeah, thank you to Roto Grinders for letting us do this, and maybe we'll get a sponsor someday that I can thank, but today we don't. We'll catch you all next time.